The Shoreshame Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Hello everyone, this is Bill, and we want to welcome you to this tour portion called Ekev. Ekev. And it's taking from Devarim, or Deuteronomy, chapter 7, verse 12 through 11:25. Now, in this portion, Moses continues to encourage the people to keep God's commandments and to safeguard that which has been entrusted to them. And if they would do this, as a reward of that commitment, or as a result of that commitment, which is the word ekev, then God would love them, He would bless them, and He would multiply them. And we find that in verse 13 of chapter 7 in our portion. Now, the word ekev, as I've already said, means reward, or it might mean as a result of something. But it also means heel, H-E-E-L. That's underneath our feet would be the inference. And there is some rabbinical commentary to suggest that this word would hint at those commands that might be considered insignificant to some. In other words, something that they would tread on with their heel. But besides heel, the word ekev also means end, E-N-D, which is to say a small or end manner. And I would say that does not mean insignificant, but it means small in comparison to the concept of head or rosh. Because the head is something that speaks of maturity. The head is something that speaks of producing fruit, the heads of grain, if you will. So the potential is in the heel or in the ekev. But that is simply hinting at a potential gift or talent that comes to fruition in the head. People who have unfulfilled goals, those things that they felt like were within them to do, but somehow in life it just never materialized, a lot of those people live unhappy lives because they know that there is an untapped potential. There are those things that did not come to fruition that perhaps should have. So likewise, lives that don't mature in God's word are going to be unfulfilled lives. You know, people who stay in one place, spiritually speaking, are going to live unfulfilled lives because the word of God is likened unto a seed, and that seed is going to grow and to mature into a plant, and that plant is supposed to produce fruit. In fact, it's supposed to produce a lot of fruit. So the word heal then hints at the potential, but the head speaks of the fruition. Interestingly, the word akev, spelled ayin kuf bet, is the root of the word for, or name, I should say, Yaakov, or Jacob, by simply attaching the letter yod to akev, or ekev, heel, the result is Yaakov. Yet, he became Yisrael. And so Yisrael, if you will, is the fruition. It's the head. It's the maturing of what started as Yaakov, or heel. It's also interesting to me that within the word Yisrael, in the spelling of it, it's Yud, Shin, Resh, Aleph, Lamed. But within it, you have the Shin, Resh, Aleph at the very heart of the word Yisrael. That is simply a permutation of the word Resh, Aleph, Shin, Rosh. So again, in the word heel or akev, you see the potential. But in the word Rosh or head, you see the fruition. In Yaakov, we see the potential. But in Yisrael, we see the fruition. Now, speaking of Israel in this regard, Moses said this in Devarim 28, verse 13. And the Lord will make you the head, that is Rosh, and not the tail. You shall be above only and not be beneath. If you heed the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you today, and are careful to observe them. And so there it is. If you heed the commands of the Lord, then you're going to be the head. if you're committed, that begins as a seed in you is going to mature and it's going to come to fruition. And so the emphasis of this siddur is the beneficial consequences, or if you will, the reward, the fruition of fearing Him, and the reward of loving Him and keeping His commands. And that is to be the head and not the tail. Or let's put it this way, not to always be known as Jacob, but to be referred to as Israel. Because Israel is the nation that has been set apart from the nations to keep His covenant. And if they are fulfilling their mandate, what pertains to that head nation, Israel, is going to emanate to the rest of the nations. And so, in pursuit of this goal, we're going to see that it is necessary that Israel maintains its integrity in the face of idolatry. That Israel will need to learn that physical bread or physical things are not what we need most. And that Israel must accept suffering as a means of learning discipline and self-control so that we can mature into the head and to be what the Father created Israel to be. Now in chapter 7 and verse 12, as it begins, it says, "When you hearken, you will to guard and to do these things, that He will love you, He will bless you, and He will multiply you." In verse 14, in fact, it tells us that Israel is to be blessed above all peoples. And inherent in that statement, I believe, is because Israel is that nation that is called and to be set apart to keep the commands of God, because in keeping His commands, there are inherent blessings. So if you listen, if you hearken, if you guard these things, if you do these things, I'm going to love you, I'm going to bless you, I'm going to multiply you. In fact, you're going to be blessed above all people. In short, if we produce good fruit, because we were formed from the dust of the earth, when we, as, if I can put it this way, the dust of the earth, produce good fruit, that is, produce the fruit of God's instructions, then the dust from which we came will also produce good fruit. But if we don't produce that fruit, the dust from which we came will not either. And so, to be blessed, to multiply in this land that He's given to Israel, it is incumbent upon us to produce good fruit, to keep His commands. Now, just an observation, maybe better put a question, is this truly going to be attained before the Messianic era? Because, in other words, if we are going to hearken and guard and do all these things that we've been commanded to do so that we can be loved, blessed, and multiplied in the way the Father has intended it to be, has that happened? Is it happening? Or is it something that is going to be, that's going to come to fruition during the Messianic era? In my opinion, Ezekiel 36 seems to indicate that it won't reach its fruition until then. But that's just an observation on my part. Now in verse 14 and 15, he goes on and he says, if you're doing these things, that there will be no barren among you. There'll be no barren among your cattle. There'll be no sickness among you, etc. And the sicknesses and the diseases of Egypt aren't going to be found among you, but are going to be placed among those who hate Israel. Now that's an interesting statement, because one commentator describes Egypt as being the, quote, mother of worst diseases. Now, seeing that there is barrenness and sickness, once again, is this something that is to be attained before the Messianic era or during the Messianic era? And again, my opinion, it seems that it comes to fruition at the Messianic era, when there's one flock with one shepherd, one king, one people. In verse 16, it says, in dispelling the nations from the land, you are not to take pity on them, you are not to look to their gods, because if you look to their gods, they will be a snare unto you. And that word in Hebrew, translated snare, is mokesh. Mokesh, and it's spelled mem vav kuf shin. And interestingly, to me anyway, this word mokesh, snare, is numerically equivalent to the word mavit. Mem vav tav, mavit. Or death, because their gods and what they represent, although they may appear attractive, but they are also death. And so the snare is equivalent to death. Now in Psalm 18, verse 5, the psalmist writes, "The sorrows of Sheol surrounded me, the snares, Mokesh, of death, Mavit, confronted me." And so again, just to kind of underscore the idea that snares, these gods, these things that appear so attractive, are that. They are snares. They are intended to bring death upon you. And of course, this follows perfectly with the methodology of the adversary from the very beginning, because he presents things that appear good, but he conceals the death. He conceals the evil. He seduces the woman with the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But I guarantee you, he was not showing her the evil side of it, but the good side of it. And so these gods that were a snare unto them were often overlaid with gold or silver or ornaments or these things that are going to catch the eye. But they are a snare, Mokesh, which is also translated noose. And if you think about it, in the context of a snare being a noose, usually the noose would catch the prey by their heel. Ekev. Now in verse 17 it says, "If you say, these nations are more than we are, they're mightier than we are," he goes on and says, "you shall not be afraid." And what becomes clear in the text is that rather than fearing them, fear God. And he goes on to tell them, you fear God more than them, because remember what I did to Egypt, and remember what I did to Pharaoh and all of his hosts, and how that entire civilization was brought down by purely supernatural means. In other words, this happened when Israel was enslaved and they could not fight at all. And yet God brought down Egypt and Pharaoh and all of his might simply because he determined that he was going to bring Israel out. And so if he supernaturally destroyed Egypt and all of its might, then why should Israel, now a free people, and armed, by the way, with the weapons that came from the Egyptians destroyed in the sea. In fact, let me read quickly here from Josephus, who says that on the next day, this is after the crossing of the Red Sea, on the next day Moses gathered together the weapons of the Egyptians, which were brought to the camp of the Hebrews by the current of the sea and the force of the winds resisting it. And he conjectured that this also happened by divine providence, that so they might not be destitute of weapons. In other words, what I'm saying is when you see these nations and you say to yourself, they're mightier than we are, they're bigger than we are, do not fear them. Fear me. I destroyed Egypt when you didn't have weapons. I destroyed Egypt and Pharaoh when you were enslaved. I opened up the sea, caused you to pass over on dry land, caused the sea to come down on top of them, and then caused the current of the sea to wash up all their arms onto the seashore so that you could go pick them up and fight as free men. And so, when you go to war with these people, don't fear them. Remember where you got your weapons from and how you got them. Once again, fear God rather than fear man. Also remember that it was their fear of the giants, these Anakim that were in the land. That is what led to 40 years of wandering. And that 40 years of wandering, we see, was to teach them to depend upon God. So again, don't fear them, fear me. Do what I say, because if you do what I say, then you know you're going to prevail. Now, before we move on here, Yeshua echoed this principle when in Matthew chapter 10, verse 28, he says, "Do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." Now, there's a Talmudic saying that goes something like this: "Everything is in the hands of heaven. other than the fear of heaven. God controls everything, determines everything, except how we're going to respond to Him. Are we going to fear Him more than we fear man? Only a person can develop that quality within themselves. And if we fear Him more than we fear others, then we are going to be provoked to keep His commands. In Psalm 111, verse 10, it says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning." And that word there is reshit. And the root of reshit is the word rosh. So, if you will, beginning is related to the idea of head, the maturity. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all those who do His commandments. So again, the root of beginning is the word rosh. And so the result of wisdom is doing His commandments. But the beginning of wisdom is fearing Him. The reward of keeping His commandments, or the ekev, is blessing and life. Because what emanates from the head, or rosh, is going to affect the entire being from head to toe. And so, going hand in glove with fear of Him is humility. Because if you fear Him, then you're not going to be proud and stubborn and stiff-necked and obstinate. If your fear of God is greater than fear of man, then before God, you're going to walk in humility. And so, in Proverbs chapter 22, verse 4, it says, "By humility and the fear of the Lord are riches and honor and life." Now, we also want to understand that Moses, the meekest man alive, is the one God gave understanding of His instructions. He is the one who taught the people what these things mean, this meek man, this humble man. And so, our humility and our fear of God is going to affect how we think and how we walk these things out. And in other words, what I'm trying to say is that those who fear God are also going to walk humbly before God, not proud and erect. And those are the ones who are going to have honor, they're going to have life, they're going to have abundance, they're going to have prosperity as God intends prosperity to be. They're going to have understanding. Now in verse 20, it says that God will send a hornet among them, that is the inhabitants of the land of Canaan, in order to dispel them. Now the Hebrew word hornet is tzira, and that's spelled zari resh ein he. And this particular word comes from a root word that means to erupt. In fact, this is where the term zaret comes from. And of course, zaret is translated leprosy. And so it's interesting to me that the word for hornet is related to the whole concept of where we get the zaret, the leprosy. It's also related to the root word that means to cast out or to vomit out in some translations, implying that where the inhabitants of Canaan were concerned, the time had come for the land to vomit them out because of their abominations. And in part, God would send the zira. He would send the hornet to cause these eruptions and to bring about this casting or vomiting out. And so, therefore, because this is what is going to happen to them, don't be enticed by their gods, lest this happen to you. Now, while these hornets, I believe, are most likely literal, some have supposed that this particular statement, that I will send the hornets among them, is an allusion to the king of Egypt, Thutmose III, because this particular Egyptian king, his emblem was the hornet. And historically, his invasions of Canaan would have weakened the fighting ability of the inhabitants. So that's very possible. It's also very likely, I think, that he sent literal hornets, like he said. But I also believe that it's hinting at the whole concept here is the time has come to vomit them out. The land can no longer tolerate their perverseness and their wickedness, and so the time has come. And so in verse 21, he says, don't fear. Don't fear these people, for the Lord is in the midst of you. Now, there's perhaps two ways that we can look at that statement and glean something from it. Number one, he's suggesting that because he's in the midst of you, that he's going to fight for you. He's with you. But I want you to also consider that it may be implying that being fearful of these other people while I am in your midst is troublesome to me. So, don't fear them because I'm in your midst. In other words, your fear of others while I was in your midst caused you to wander all these 40 years. And so now that the time has come for the land to vomit them out, do not fear them. I am in your midst. I'm watching. In verse 22, he says that he will cast them out little by little, and the reason being lest the beasts become too populous. Because apparently there would be a vacuum of people, and that would allow these wild beasts to multiply unabated. This, by the way, is also referred to in Exodus chapter 23, verse 29. And so apparently the nations, or the inhabitants, would keep the beasts at bay until Israel is ready to fully possess the land. So he does it little by little. Now here's an interesting thought. If beasts are an issue at the end of days, and they are, does the fact that these beasts in the end of days roaming about imply a widespread vacuum, if I can use that word, of human beings? In other words, in Revelation chapter 6, verse 8, it says that beasts are going to be used to help destroy a fourth of the earth. And so might it be that because so many people are dying and being destroyed, that this allows these beasts to multiply at a great rate, that which simply complicates all the other issues that humanity is facing during that terrible time. Now in verse 25 and 6, it says, don't covet the silver and gold of the idols. Don't bring it into your house. These images, as we said, were typically overlaid with precious metals, and those things have a tendency of catching your eye. But again, that which looks good to you, you need to understand, is a snare to you. It's a noose. It's something that can catch you by the heel. It might seem insignificant to you, but it grows into something bigger. And so it's a snare to you. And so by bringing abominable things into your house, you and your house become accursed. Now, some rabbinical commentary extends this particular prohibition to profiting from anything that is obtained in violation of the Torah. In other words, if you see or if you engage in some kind of an activity that's unlawful and you happen to profit by it and you bring that profit into your home, then that too becomes a curse. That is something that will also pollute your house. For instance, in Judges chapter 7, Israel was told at the defeat of Jericho what to do with all the booty and all the spoil. You know, and some things were to be set aside, some things were not to be taken, etc. But Achan took the accursed thing into his tent. And as a result, when Israel goes out to fight the battle of Ai, A-I, which is a contraction of Ayin, which is the Hebrew term, the eye, they lost the battle of the eye. Why? Because Achan's eye looked at the gold and the silver and not the prohibition against that. And as a result, Israel lost the battle of the eye. He and his family perished so that Israel could be cleansed from the accursed thing. So again, the point would be, these things that have a tendency of catching your eye are a snare unto you. That's the way the adversary works. He throws something out there that looks good, but he always conceals the death that's within it. Now in chapter 8, we see that the wandering in the wilderness was designed to teach Israel humility. It was designed to teach them to fear God and Consequently, to rely upon Him exclusively and not to look to anything or anyone else. Because during the entire time they were in the wilderness, they lacked nothing. And that becomes very clear in the Torah portion. Now, they're entering a fertile land. They're not going into a wilderness. They're going into a very fertile land. And so, you're going to have things at your fingertips now that you didn't have for the last 40 years. And so, you need to call upon that training that you received in the wilderness to be humble, to fear God, and to rely upon Him and not your own hand and not your own power. And even though the wilderness was disciplinary because of the evil report that the 10 spies brought, and then, of course, the people bought into, even though it was disciplinary, it was not destructive. It was constructive, again, to produce humility, to produce fear of God, to produce reliance upon God, to produce that willingness to walk according to His instructions. Now, just a footnote to that, perhaps for that same purpose, His people will once again be guided into the wilderness. Because according to Hosea 2, for instance, He is going to lure her into the wilderness. And interestingly enough, it says that He will give her vineyards from there. And the valley of Achor, and that is where Achan was buried, by the way. Because remember, Achan is the one whose eye is fascinated with these things that he's not supposed to take. He brings them into his house and into his tent. And as a result, Israel loses the battle of the eye. Well, the very place that he was buried would become a door of hope, it says, or an entrance of hope. And so what I'm trying to get at is, perhaps if the wilderness experience was to produce discipline, to produce humility, to fear of God, reliance upon God, perhaps that's why Hosea 2 and other passages say that there's coming a day when God draws His people back into the wilderness, perhaps to accomplish the same thing. Now in verse 1, it says that if you observe, or by guarding these commandments, here's what it's going to result in. You will live, you will multiply, and you will possess the land. So living, multiplying, and possessing the land. All three of those things are dependent upon guarding all of His commands. So here's the question. If those things, living, multiplying, possessing the land, are dependent on guarding all of the commands, what happens if you don't? In verse 2, it talks about afflicting you. He said these things you were allowed to go through these things, all these difficulties to afflict you. All these things were to demonstrate to you that He alone provides. Because in the wilderness, they had no food reserves. And every day, except for Shabbat, they had to trust that the manna would be there every day. In fact, on the sixth day, they had to trust that a double portion would be there every time. Now, as a man, I want to interject myself into that situation because I know how I think. That would be, I believe, for men, the hardest thing. Because men have a tendency, at least this is my tendency, to be concerned, to worry, where's the money for the bills going to come from, how we're going to pay this, how we're going to take care of that, etc. Because as a man, it's kind of created within us to care about those things. That's what we do. We go out and we work and we make a living to take care of our wife, to take care of our children. And so not having the ability to do those things, being in the wilderness, so to speak, I would imagine that men, perhaps, more than the women, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm just contemplating that maybe the men had the hardest time with this. But the point, once again, is God allowed this to happen so that He could prove to them that He was the only one that they could rely on. And He goes on to say this was in order to test them to know what was in your heart, whether or not you're going to keep My commandments. Because in adversity, this is where you discover what is truly inside of a person. If you take a grape and you squeeze it, what's inside is going to come out. And I believe it's the same for a person. When that person or people, family, nation, what have you, are being squeezed by adversity and difficulty, whatever's on the inside, it's going to come outside. So now overall, in this particular case, here's what I think he discovered. That for a large percentage of the people, it was not in their heart to keep his commandments. In fact, that's evident, at least to me, in the previous Torah portion, when Moses carries the words of the people to God in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 29, God says this, "Oh, that they had such a heart in them, that they would fear me, and always keep all my commandments, that it might be well with them and with their children forever." And so, before God begins to give them the Mishpatim, the judgments, which begins in Exodus chapter 21, he knew what was in their heart. Because when they obtained the golden calf, this is what they said, "This is your God, O Israel, that led you up out of Egypt." So, he brought them through the wilderness to test them, to expose them to difficult situations, to know whether or not it was in your heart to keep my commandments or not. And in this particular case, again, for many of them, he found it was not in their heart. And so Moses recalls all these things to kind of very subtly, I guess, prove the point that, look, here's what's happened in the past. Don't make the same mistake. In verse 3, it says that he afflicted you, and he caused you to hunger. And what's interesting to me about that word hunger, the root term is re'av. And re'av is also the Hebrew word for famine. So in a sense, what it says is he allowed you to experience famine in order to teach you what is most important. Because physical food is not the only thing that ensures man's existence. Man will seek out what physical bread cannot fill. And that can either be God's word, or that can be what we'll call comfort food. And that comfort food may be different things for different people. But man can have all the riches in the world and still be unsatisfied. But he will seek something. He will search for that something to fill that empty spot. And again, in some cases, that'll be what God says, and in a lot of cases, that'll be what culture and society says, or what his own desires are, that comfort food. But the problem about comfort food is that that which comforts us is usually not what is best for us and leads to obesity. And I'm not just talking in the physical sense. It will lead to obesity, and it will lead to laziness, and the body will begin to be neglected, and disease sets in, and before long, death. So the point is, he exposed you to all these things. He caused you to hunger. He caused you to experience famine, in a sense, to teach you that the needs of the spiritual life are not to be neglected. The physical bread is not what we need most, and that's why he allowed them to hunger, to teach them that physical bread is not what we need most, but what we need most is the bread that comes from heaven. Of course, that bread is Yeshua, born in Bethlehem, the house of bread. And so, in John chapter 6, verse 41, we understand that he says, "I am the bread which came down from heaven." Because the purpose of allowing them to hunger was to turn right around and feed them this manna, but in feeding them, to teach them that the bread they needed most was the Word of God. Because that is how man truly lives, by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. And if Yeshua is that bread that came down from heaven, then every word would include him. That's how man truly lives. So once again, he allowed them to hunger. He allowed them to experience famine, if we can put it that way. But he gives them bread to teach them that that physical bread will only fill you for a while. Because what you're going to find is What you need more than anything else is every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. And when man ceases to acknowledge that, perhaps that's why God allows him to hunger. Let's put it this way. Maybe it's possible that physical famine is to teach people of our spiritual neglect. Physical famine, perhaps, is merely a physical manifestation of a spiritual issue. Consider the prodigal only came to his senses when he was suffering as a result of the famine. Only then did he realize the need in serving his father, rather than asking his father to give me what I've got coming to me. Now, the reason this is so, I think, important is because Amos chapter 8, verse 11 prophesies of a time when there will be a famine, not of bread or a thirst for water, but a famine for hearing the words of the Lord. To me, this seems to say, if my people don't want to live by every word that proceeds from my mouth, and I believe that that would be the case today, that most of his people don't live by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God, then perhaps he will say, okay, if you don't want to hear what I got to say, you're not going to hear it. And then there's going to be a famine for the hearing of the words of the Lord. And perhaps that even manifests in a physical sense that there's going to be a famine. The manna was a test to Israel. He allowed them to hunger to give them manna. And that in itself was a test because they had never seen this stuff before. They asked, what is it? They didn't know at that point in time if they could live on manna alone. It was a mystery to them. And so, likewise, most people view the Word of God and they understand what's right and wrong per se, but they don't know if they can live that way. They don't know if they can trust God day to day to day to day. And so what happens is he allows them to hunger. He allows them to experience famine. And then he turns right around and gives them what they need, gives them their daily bread to teach them that these physical things that you long for are not what you need the most. What you need the most is every word that proceeds from my mouth. Depend on me, fear me, love me, serve me. That is what you need to digest, and that is what you need to internalize. Now, in verse 5, it says that as a man chastens his son, the Lord chastens you. And it becomes very clear, here's why he did this. Because he loves you. So we shouldn't be surprised then when in Revelation chapter 3, verse 19, Yeshua says to Laodicea, as many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Therefore be zealous and repent. Now he is speaking to Laodicea, which is the mingled or mixed congregation, but yet he doesn't cast them off. To the contrary, he says, I want you to repent. And if I have to rebuke you, and if I have to chasten you in order to provoke you to repent, that's what I'm willing to do because I love you. And so the hunger, the manna itself, was chastening, was disciplining in order to develop a son. Because God's discipline is not to destroy, but to restore. Job 36 puts it this way. He delivers the afflicted by their affliction and opens their ear in oppression. Because when people are exposed to adversity and affliction and oppression, guess what? They're all ears and they're listening and they're ready and motivated to respond to what God is saying. And by that, they're delivered from their affliction. People have a tendency of becoming more spiritually tuned in when they are deprived of what makes us spiritually lazy in the first place. If we've got plenty of bread, so to speak, then we get lazy, we get apathetic, we get fat, we get obese, and we're not spiritually tuned in. But when those things are taken away, we have the tendency to revert back to that spiritual keenness. And so the Creator loves us enough that if He has to come to that, that's what He'll do. And so as the people are preparing to go into the land, He's warning them, don't become lazy. You're going into a fertile land that's flowing with milk and honey, and it's going to be bounteous, and you're going to be tempted to get fat and lazy, spiritually speaking. Don't do it. Paul teaches that if we are going to attain the glory with Messiah, it's going to require that we suffer or be afflicted. The Spirit Himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God, and if children, then heirs. Heirs of God and joint heirs with Messiah, if indeed we suffer with Him, that we may also be glorified together. In other words, this suffering or this affliction plays a role in becoming the sons of God that He speaks of. So what I'm trying to say is this is not something that is relative to just that generation that entered the land. This is something that God speaks to all of His people throughout the ages, that I will expose you to adversity and affliction and difficulties, not to destroy you, but to develop you, to provoke you to maturity, to become my sons that are going to fear me, that are going to hear me, that are going to love me, that are going to live according to my instructions. And this is reiterated for us, in a sense, by Paul in Romans chapter 8. And this is the standard that is established by the Messiah. That is, in order to enter into the glory, you have to be willing to endure the suffering. Because when He speaks to two of His disciples on the road to Emmaus in Luke chapter 24, verse 26, He says, "Ought not the Messiah to have suffered these things and to enter His glory?" In other words, before entering the glory, He had to suffer. And so Messiah establishes the standard. And so we shouldn't be surprised that if we want to enjoy and attain the glory with Messiah, then we have to be willing to suffer with Him. Let me put it this way. We have to be willing to die to ourselves. We have to be willing to die to our thought process, what we think is most important, what we'd rather things be, and we have to embrace His will. And that is the process of fulfilling the Father's will, dying to me. The word that sums it up, as far as I'm concerned, is kadosh, holy, set apart. Because to be set apart, we have to live a set-apart life. And it's God's Torah that defines what that set-apart life looks like. And by embracing His instructions, internalizing them, observing and doing, that means I have to die to my will. I have to die to myself. Now in chapter 8, or as chapter 8 continues, he, in verse 9, begins to talk to them about this land that you're going to enter, this very good land. And he says, it's a land where you shall eat bread without scarceness. In other words, it's a land of plenty. Now, there's a commentator that says that in the 19th century, of course, that's when he was writing, that Arabs maybe tasted bread once a month, and a lot of them, not even that often. Now, that's notable to me for a couple of reasons. Number one, he's comparing the neighboring countries and peoples and how consistently they eat bread with how consistently Israel was going to eat bread. But it's also notable because Israel most likely wandered through Arabia. And so if back then Arabs were only eating bread once a month, notice that Israel was eating manna every day. And so what comes to mind is, you prepare a table for me in the presence of my enemies. In other words, Israel, if they're walking the way they're supposed to walk, will flourish even while their adversaries are struggling. If bread is the word or the Torah, it's also implying about the land that that's where the word flourishes. That's where the Torah truly flourishes, because even in our day and time, most countries are not conducive to living by God's Torah. Well, I'd say all countries are not conducive to living by God's Torah. The only land from Scripture, it seems, that is conducive to living by the Torah is the land of Israel. And so some rabbinical commentary suggests that what he means, or what he hints at when he says that you will eat bread without scarceness, is referring to the Torah, because the Torah, or the Word, is bread, and it's going to flourish there. It works there in that land better than any other place. This land, and those living according to his commands, as far as I'm concerned, equates to what we have in the very beginning of time in the Garden of Eden. Because when man transgressed God's commands, there is no Garden of Eden. And that is until the end of the age, when the people are returning to the land and keeping his commandments. And you can read about that in Ezekiel chapter 36. It says, the land that was desolate has become like the Garden of Eden. In other words, what I'm saying is, without getting into all the details of it, Israel is a special land, because I believe that's where the Garden of Eden was. And the Garden of Eden was where at first is where those people that God had sent there were keeping his commands. And everything was flourishing. It was as it was intended to be. But when man transgressed those commands, he had to leave that land. He was exiled from that land. And there is no mention of the Garden of Eden as being a place on earth until, again, Ezekiel 36 and some other prophets start talking about within the context of his people being gathered from all the countries and returning to that land and keeping his commands, then we see that the land that was desolate has become like the Garden of Eden. Now in verse 10, I'm sure I just lost some of you on that one, hopefully not, but anyway. In verse 10 it says, when you eat and are satisfied, you are to bless the Lord. And this is the basis of grace after meals. And of course, rabbinically, grace after meals consists of four primary parts. There is a thanksgiving for food, there is a thanksgiving for the land, there's the thanksgiving for the temple, and then there's this general thanksgiving and praise. But at any rate, this is the basis of the grace after meals, thanking God for the good land that he's given us after we eat and we're full. Because we don't want to be deluded into thinking that, you know, I'm the one who went out there and worked hard and grew all that and brought it in here and fed my family, and it's because of me that we're full. No. We've simply been given the opportunity to live in a good land where those things are possible. But ultimately, the provision comes from the Creator who gave us this land. And so we're to thank him. Now, in Judaism, the dinner table is considered to be an altar. And because it's considered to be an altar, not only do they bless after, but they bless before. However, the blessing always focuses on the one giving the food, not the food itself. In fact, in verse 11, he says, beware lest you forget. In other words, you're full. Your bellies are full now, you're content. Don't allow the lure of prosperity to cause you to forget who is responsible for all these things. Because prosperity, security, these things that everybody wants, tends to dull our senses to the one who granted us these things. And then when we get dull to that, then we neglect to keep his commands, and when we neglect to keep his commands, that advances this forgetfulness that we have. And so that not only pertained to that generation that was about to enter the land, but it pertains to this generation as well, and I would say especially this generation, and specifically Western civilization, because this is a malady that affects believers in this very day at this time. So no wonder then that Elijah's mission, according to Malachi chapter 4, is to call the children to return to the fathers and to call the children to remember. Malachi 4 verse 4 and 5. Remember the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded him in Horeb for all Israel, with the statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. In other words, he has to come and tell the children to remember the law of Moses. Why? Because obviously they have neglected it. They have forgotten it. They grew prosperous. They lived in security. They grew obese. They grew lazy. And they got forgetful. And so Elijah has to come on the scene to stir them up, to provoke them to remember the law of Moses, the Torah of Moses, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to the fathers. Because when all these blessings came our way, as is described in the Torah portion, houses, herds, plenty, money, we forgot him. Yet he is the one who rained manna down from heaven. He's the one who gave water from a rock in the middle of nowhere. And here's why he did it, according to verse 16, to do you good at your latter end, literally in your later days. In other words, the reason I did all these things in these difficult circumstances was once again to prove to you that I'm the only one that you can depend upon. You can't even depend on yourself. I'm the one who did this for you. You can't bring water from a rock. You can't rain manna down from heaven. Only I can do that. And so I did this so that it would be good for you at the latter end or your later days. Rabbinically, they believe that is to say that the wilderness experience was training for national existence in the land. Okay, I won't argue with that, but I also believe it pertains to our generation and our time. In other words, let's put it this way. Our God is a good general, and he's not going to send a green recruit to the front line of battle. He's going to put him through training, and training is difficult, and that training is intended to break your will. Not break your spirit, but break your will so that you conform to the will of your commanding officer. Now in verse 17, he warns Israel against thinking and saying, my power and my might have accomplished this. Or let's put it in today's vernacular. Good old American know-how and ingenuity is what we need. Thinking that we have the power, we have the might to accomplish all this, the civilization and society that we've constructed. Actually, it's the Creator who gave us the ability to do these things. And so he says, don't say this of yourself. Don't think this, because it's the Lord in verse 18 who gives power to get wealth. And in Israel's case, what he's saying, the word power is koch, and the reason he gives them power to attain wealth, well, that's the method. That's the methodology, but the goal is this. For the sake of establishing the covenant made with the fathers. And in Hebrew, the term is leman, for the sake of. The reason I gave you power to attain wealth was for the goal of, or for the sake of, establishing the covenant that I made with your fathers. In other words, I'm not necessarily doing this for your sake. I'm doing it because I made a promise to them. I established my covenant with them. And now I've given you the power, the ability to attain wealth that, or for the sake of establishing that, validating that covenant that I made with your fathers. He would fulfill the promise that he made to the fathers. But it also seems to imply that the continuance of that blessing that you are going to enjoy is dependent on your commitment. Not theirs, but your commitment to be obedient. Now in chapter 9, he continues to warn them against self-righteousness. Because he tells them, I'm going to be with you and you're going to dispossess these people that are in the land. But he also makes it very clear that these pending victories are not going to be the result of their righteousness, but because of the promise that he had made to the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In verse 1, he says, you're going to dispossess these nations that are greater and mightier than you, which is interesting because he goes on and says, they're people great and tall, and he even mentions the son of Anakim, the giants. In other words, what I'm getting at is, this part of the spies' report was true. Moses is acknowledging that that part of the report was true. The problem in the spies' report was that they thought that they had to accomplish this on their own. They thought that we've got to fight these people. We've got to come up against these son of Anakim, these giants. That was the problem. They weren't trusting that God would fight their battle. They were not trusting that God would do exactly what he said he would do. Because now as they prepare to enter the land, they're going to face these same peoples. They're going to face these great and tall people, these nations greater and mightier than you, these sons of Anakim, these giants. However, you need to understand that God is the one who's going over before you as a devouring fire. In verse 4, when this happens, don't think that this happened because of your righteousness, but it happened because of the wickedness of the nations. Again, the time had come for them to be vomited out. Likewise, let me interject this. It's not because of my righteousness that I've been grafted into the family, but it was because of the unbelief of others. And the unbelief of others gave me the opportunity to hear the message and to respond to it. And so Paul warns in Romans 11, verse 19 and 20, you will say then, branches were broken off that I might be grafted in. Well said. Because of unbelief, they were broken off, and you stand by faith. Do not be haughty, but fear. And so, even though it's apples and oranges, the same principle is present. Israel's going to go possess the land, but don't think it's because you're so righteous. More than your righteousness is their wickedness. And not only that, but I made a promise to your fathers. Likewise, those of us who've been grafted in, you know why you were grafted in? Because there were people who didn't believe and their branches were broken off to make room for you. And now you've responded accordingly. And now you believe, but don't get haughty. Don't think it's because you're all that great and wonderful. But fear. Walk humbly. Those who attended the wedding of the king's son were there because others didn't want to come. That's in Matthew chapter 22. So I guess what I'm getting at is this. Where it stands today, and I believe this was true back then too, the calling and the purpose, and if you want to use the word destiny, that has been placed upon us as individuals, as people, as a body, it is not a validation of who I am. It's not a pat on the back to say, well, because you are who you are, Bill, we're going to do this. I'm going to do this. No. It's not a validation of who I am, but it's a challenge to become who I am not. In other words, the heel is the potential. Ekev is the potential. But the idea is to develop into the head. Yaakov, Jacob, if we can use it that way, is the potential. But Israel is the fruition. And so back to the land, he drove them out because of their wickedness to make way for Israel, but not because of Israel's righteousness. And he reiterates this in verse 5. He says, it's not because of the uprightness of your heart. It's that he might establish the word that he gave to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. And again in verse 6, it says the land is given to Israel because of his promise. Now, again, let's bring the end time into this in the latter generations. In Ezekiel 36, look at what he says in verses 22 and 3. Therefore say to the house of Israel, thus says the Lord God, I do not do this for your sake. And he's talking about bringing them out of all the different countries that they've been scattered to, bringing them back into their own land. I do not do this for your sake, O house of Israel, but for my holy name's sake, which you have profaned among the nations wherever you went. And I will sanctify my great name, which has been profaned among the nations, which you have profaned in their midst. And the nations shall know that I am the Lord, says the Lord God, when I am hallowed in you before their eyes. And once again, making it very clear that the reason I'm doing this is not because you're great and wonderful people and upright and righteous. I'm doing it for my name's sake. I'm doing it because I made a promise. In verse 8, Moses reminds Israel that you are prone to angering God, and he specifically mentions the golden calf incident. In fact, had it not been for Moses and his intercession at that point in time, Israel would have perished. And of course, in previous Torah portions, we've discussed this. In fact, see that Moses is a representation of Yeshua. Had it not been for Yeshua's intercession and Yeshua's willingness to die on behalf of the people, that Israel would have perished. But nevertheless, the golden calf incident stands out as the most atrocious of offenses. Notice that that was happening even as God was delivering the tables or the tablets of the covenant. Even as God was giving them and writing and inscribing the covenant in stone, that's what they were doing. Now, a footnote. Perhaps the worship of the beast in the end days is the equivalent of the golden calf incident in the desert. In other words, Moses went to the top of the mountain per their request, but he did not return when they expected him to. When he's coming down from the mountain, because he didn't return when they thought he would, they already began to worship the image of a beast. And even while he presents his Torah, some are turning to their own version of God. And so what I'm getting at is this most atrocious of events and offenses and transgressions in Israel's history, is it to be repeated in some way in the future? Specifically what's described for us in Revelation chapter 13. That's just a thought and just an observation. Now, verse 17, Moses tells them that these tablets, this covenant, was broken before your eyes. It was a sign that the covenant had been broken. He also, verse 20, makes it clear that not only was God angry with the people, but he was angry with Aaron as well. In fact, I had to intercede on behalf of Aaron because God was ready to wipe him out as well. In verse 21, it says that the calf is your sin, and he burnt it with fire, he said. He beat it in pieces, and then he ground it to dust, and then this dust was cast into the brook that descended from the mountain. And so, even though it doesn't mention it, of course, he took that water that had been mixed with this dust from this idol, and he made them drink it. But here's the point. Moses, who is playing the role of the intercessor, makes their sin, because he calls the calf your sin, he made it disappear. Now, the removal of the idol, the sin, had to precede the removal of the guilt. And of course, Yeshua is our intercessor, being willing to die on behalf of his people Israel. He removes that sin. He who knew no sin became sin for us. And so I no longer walk under the penalty of death because of Yeshua. Now in chapter 10, we see the result of Moses' intercession and some of the things that happened after that. Number one, in verse 3, we see that Moses made an ark of acacia wood to store the new tablets in. Now, I'm not being an advocate for or an opponent of this particular position. I'm just bringing it out that there are midrashim that suggest Moses made a temporary ark to hold these tablets and the broken ones as well. And that was what was used until Bezalel made the permanent one. Again, I don't know. I wasn't there. But this is kind of an interesting thought. And so when Bezalel completed the permanent one, then Moses deposited the new covenant into that ark. And some traditions even say that he put the broken ones in there as well. But at any rate, at the time when those first tablets were broken, that's when Levi, the tribe of Levi, was elevated to the status of priest. Now, in one of my commentaries, it makes a statement that just grabbed my eye. And it just says simply that the tribe of Levi had held aloof from the rest of the people. They had been kind of removed themselves from the rest of the people. Read into that. Maybe they were sensing something going on within the rest of the body. And so they started to separate themselves and to remain aloof from the rest of the people. So then when Moses comes and he says, who's on the Lord's side? Levi's already prepared to gather to him. They had apparently, already separated themselves from a people who were also called to be set apart. In other words, Levi represents those who are set apart among those who are set apart. And the fact that this commentator says that they were aloof was very interesting to me because, and maybe I shouldn't even bring this up, but my sense is that there are those in the body that find it necessary to be aloof from a lot of the rest of the body. Not because they think they're better than anybody else. It's because they sense that there's something going on in the body that's going to come to the surface very soon. And when it happens, it's not going to be good. And they don't want to be partakers of that. They don't want to be found associated with that. And so they're remaining aloof from the rest of the body. And so you can take that for what it's worth. Now in verse 9, Moses makes it clear that Levi has no portion with his brethren because their mission, their job description, is to care for and to administer the sanctuary. And because that is their mission, it does not allow for them to labor in the fields. The only reason I bring this up is because the mission of the priests is reminiscent of what Adam was told to do, that is to work and to guard. And because their mission was to work and to guard the sanctuary, they couldn't go work in the fields. In other words, what I'm getting at is they were dependent on the folks and the people bringing the offerings where they could freely eat. Well, that's exactly what was told to Adam in Genesis chapter 2, verse 16. He would freely eat of all the trees of the garden, of course, with the exception being the knowledge or the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He did not eat bread in the sweat of your face until after the transgression. What I'm getting at is that the same situation that we see for the priest is what we see in the very beginning for Adam, which would then hint that Adam's role, Adam's function, was as a priest. That's something we develop in some other teachings, a lot more than that, but it's just a kind of a footnote here. In verse 9, where Levi has no portion because their job is to take care of the sanctuary. Now, verse 10, Moses said, I stayed in the mount, and he stayed there actually for 40 days, three different times. There was the first time, and the first 40 days, he goes to the top of the mountain to receive the Mishpatim, what God says, and to receive the first tablets. Traditionally, that begins on the 7th of Sivan and goes through the 17th of Tammuz. And I say traditionally, I don't know. You can take it for what it's worth. And it was during this first period of 40 days that God taught Moses the entire Torah, or so say the rabbis. The second 40-day period was after the golden calf incident, and this is the time Moses spent interceding for the people. Because at that point in time, the people were in disfavor, God was not going to go amongst them, etc., etc., but Moses prevailed upon God to forgive them. In fact, at one point in time, Moses says, if you're going to blot them out, blot me out too. In other words, I'm willing to die for the sake of the people. And then the third period of 40 days was when Moses goes back to receive the second set of tablets. Of course, these are carved by himself, carved by man. And traditionally, this goes from the first of Elul to the 10th of Tishrei, the 10th of Tishrei, of course, being Yom Kippur. And it was during this third period of 40 days that Moses was taught God's attributes of mercy. And of course, soon thereafter, the sanctuary was constructed. Now, here's Rashi's comment on this. On the 7th of Sivan, Moses went up onto the mountain. On the 17th of Tammuz, the tablets were broken. On the 18th, he burned the golden calf and judged the transgressors. On the 19th, he went up for 40 days and pleaded for mercy. On the 1st of Elul, he went up to receive the second tablets and was there for 40 days. On the 10th of Tishrei, God restored his goodwill with the Jewish people gladly and wholeheartedly, saying to Moses, I have forgiven as you ask, and gave him the second tablet. So in other words, again, just reiterating that there were three periods of 40 days that Moses spent on top of the mountain. Now, the three periods of 40 days have been interpreted by some as being the history of man in a sense. For instance, the first 40 is when God gives Moses the first set of tablets, which are God's ideal. Those are things as they should be. The Garden of Eden is reminiscent of this. This is when there's a garden, there's a holy place, there's a man who functions as a priest, and God will come into that place and commune with him, and things are as they should be. But then we have the second 40-day period, and that is the reality of our fallen state and the need for intercession. Of course, after Adam falls, he's exiled from the garden or from the land. Man is fallen and in need of a redeemer, someone who will intercede on our behalf. And then the third set of 40 days is representative of the new covenant, because that's what the second set of tablets in reality was, a new covenant, because the first had been broken. And so the new covenant is brought about by the one, Moses, who is willing to die for Israel's benefit. But of course, Moses is simply a prototype of the Messiah. And so, in a sense, these three 40-day periods represent the history of man. Things as they should be, the reality of our fallen state, the need for intercession, and then, of course, the new covenant brought about by the one who is willing to die for Israel's benefit. And then, of course, eventually, to go into the land. Now, interestingly, at least to me, God says in Genesis chapter 6, verse 3, that man's days are 120 years. Now, of course, that's not 120 days, it's 120 years, but these three periods of 40 add up to 120. Interesting. Now, verse 12, some very, very important passages. In verse 12, Moses says to Israel, "And so what does the Lord require of you?" And the answer to that is nothing that's impossible. He says to fear him. And of course, we understand that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge in Proverbs 1, verse 7. It's the head of knowledge, if you will. But that knowledge without the fear of God is useless, because knowledge in and of itself just tends to puff up. So we have to fear him. That's the beginning of knowledge. Of course, we're to love him. And that is the initial step in the first and great command. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, and your strength. And of course, to serve him is what's required. And the result of serving him, that's what comes when the others are in their proper place. In other words, if we fear him and if we love him, we will serve him. And of course, this is similar to what the prophet admonishes us in Micah chapter 6. He says, "He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God?" And I believe that in a manner of speaking, Yeshua also addresses this when he says in Matthew 23, verse 23, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law," or the Torah, "justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone." In other words, to tithe these things or to do the commands without acknowledging justice, mercy, and faith, it's fruitless. It's pointless. In fact, the word weightier in Hebrew would be kavod, or would be related to the word kavod, which is also the word for glory. And so, in other words, the more glorious matters of the Torah are not the tithing of mint, anise, and cumin, but are justice, mercy, and faith. Do the tithing of mint, anise, and cumin, but in doing, don't overlook what God requires: justice, mercy, faith. To do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly. This is what God wants you to learn through all these things. And in verse 13, going back to the Torah portion, to do this, the purpose of it all is for your good, he says. It's not for God's benefit. It's for our benefit. And why? Because of verse 15, it says, because you've been chosen above all people. God chose Israel. He didn't choose all of the descendants of Abraham. He didn't say their descendants. He says you. He didn't choose Ishmael. He didn't choose Esau. He chose you. And he chose you to be a set apart people, to walk humbly before him, to love, to do justly, and to love mercy. And this is for your good. And therefore, in verse 16, circumcise the foreskin of your heart, or cut away the covering that would prevent his word, as it is intended to be, from penetrating your heart. Because the root word in Hebrew for foreskin, aral, means to restrict something from taking place. It's also related to a word that means unyielding. Something that's unyielding is hardened. And so what he's saying is, because the heart is the seat of desire, it's the seat of emotion, it must be open to God's purposes, or it must yield to God's purposes and not restrict what God is trying to do in your heart. So now, it's interesting that Moses is the one who first says that you have to be circumcised of heart. And so that Moses issues this admonition is very critical, because later on, Paul echoes the same thing in his letter to the Romans. He says this in chapter 2, verse 25. For circumcision is indeed profitable if you keep the law. But if you are a breaker of the law, your circumcision has become uncircumcision. Therefore, if an uncircumcised man keeps the righteous requirements of the law, will not his uncircumcision be counted as circumcision? And will not the physically uncircumcised, if he fulfills the law, judge you, who, even with your written code and circumcision, are a transgressor of the law? For he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly. And circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not from men, but from God. Let me summarize what I believe Paul's trying to get across here. He's not saying, don't be circumcised, and he's not saying, get circumcised. But simply, if you are circumcised, if you have the outward manifestation, but you don't walk in obedience, in other words, it's not in your heart, what's the point? It's pointless. On the other hand, if someone who isn't physically circumcised, who doesn't have the outward manifestation, so to speak, but nevertheless walks in obedience, that obedience, because it comes from his heart, is not negated by his uncircumcision. But to the contrary, the circumcision, or the outward of the other, is negated by his disobedience. And so this goes back to what is required of you, Israel, to fear him, to love him, and to serve him, because those are things that come from the heart. And isn't it interesting that Moses requires circumcision of the heart before Joshua requires it in the flesh? Now in verse 17, God does not show favor, it says, and he does not accept bribes. Well, you know, who is going to try to give God money? Rabbinically, it is believed that that's not what it's referring to, necessarily. But it's hinting that your performance of commandments is not atonement for transgressing those commandments. In other words, it's possible to do the things that are written in the Torah without acknowledging the purpose of those things in their heart, with paying no regard to the weightier matters. Not doing it from the heart, but doing it from the head, or doing it from a religious point of view. Because God gives reward for performance, and he gives punishment for transgression. So don't think that you can have all these ugly, wicked things in your heart, that you can keep this mitzvah or that mitzvah, and all of a sudden that atones for your transgression. No. It does not. He doesn't take a bribe, and he doesn't show favor. He still expects you to fear him, to love him, and then to serve him. verse 19, it says to love the stranger. And that word there is ger. That's in verse 19. But to love the stranger is preceded in verse 12 of this chapter by love God. And why do we bring that out? Because what are the two great commands according to Yeshua? To love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength, and another likened to it, to love your neighbor as yourself. Now, Maimonides writes concerning this particular admonition, to love the stranger. He says, quote, our parents, we are commanded to honor and fear. To the prophets, we are ordered to hearken. A man may honor and fear and obey without loving. But in the case of strangers, we are bidden to love them with the whole force of our heart's affection. In other words, this is one of those things that, again, is getting to the heart of the matter. You can fake a lot of things and do a lot of things outwardly. But if you have to love a stranger, that's going to have to come from your heart. And so, again, what is it that God wants from you? He wants your heart. Now, in chapter 11, verse 1, it says to love him and to keep his charge. Literally, it says to guard those things that he wants guarded. Love and the fear of God are the founding principles in our relationship with the Creator. And again, this echoes what was told to Adam. He was told to work and to guard. And so we, Israel, his people, are given the responsibility of properly caring for the things that are most precious to him, to work and to guard them. In verse 2, it refers to this chastisement that he placed upon them. Again, referring to the suffering that they maybe had to endure, but that was intended to teach them and to mature them. But compare the chastisement that you received, Israel, to what happened in Egypt. Because in verse 4, and I'll paraphrase, I did things to Egypt they haven't recovered from yet until this very day. In other words, when judgment comes for the nations, it means destruction. But for Israel, it means restoration, to be refined. Judgment is not necessarily a bad thing. It just depends on which side of the law you happen to be on. Now in verse 7, it says, your eyes have seen, you witnessed all these deeds, all these things that I poured out on Egypt. You didn't just hear about them, you saw them. With your own eyes, you witnessed it. So don't forget what you saw. Because you're going into a land, according to verse 10, that is not like Egypt, that you had to water by foot. And what it's understood to mean there is the rains don't really come to Egypt that much, and Egypt is dependent on the flooding of the Nile River in order to irrigate the fields. And so the people would have to haul water by foot from the Nile to irrigate the fields. But he's making that distinction between Egypt and Canaan to say that in Canaan, this land you're going into, rains flow from the mountains into streams, and that waters the land while you're sleeping. You don't even have to be outside. And so you're not going to have to do things the way you had to do them in Egypt, but consequently, because of that, the land of Canaan is going to be more dependent upon his mercy and upon his blessing. Because of its sanctity, because it is a set-apart land, it may suffer drought for lesser sins than other nations when they would commit the same thing. Verse 12, it kind of reinforces that concept, but because it says it is a land which God cares for and his eyes are always upon it. So there is no doubt that the land of Israel is special, and perhaps only when we get in the kingdom will we understand, truly understand, why it is so special. But we can say this, that the land of Israel is a land that is intended for one people, that is, Israel. And when Israel is in exile from the land, the entire world suffers. That is, according to the sages anyway. And since the exile, the land became impoverished, and only recently has the land begun to rebound. And during that time that Israel has been in exile, the entire world has degenerated. And so now we see all these things going on in the world. all these events, and a lot of people take the position that through all these cataclysmic events, earthquakes, floodings, tsunamis, etc., that the Creator is trying to speak to people. And I agree, but I don't believe the people he's trying to speak to is the world. I don't believe that's who he's trying to get the attention of. It's more intended to speak to his people, more so than it is the nations. And here is the purpose in what he's saying. Return to me, return to my ways, because redemption is at hand. The time of redemption is at hand. The time to return to the land is at hand. And so we see all these things beginning to culminate. Now, in verses 13 through 21, we come to the second portion of the Shema. Of course, the first passage is in Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 through 9. And in verse 13, he says, if you will hearken, if you listen. And rabbinical commentaries understand this to mean that if you really listen and contemplate what you have heard and what you have learned, you're going to learn even more. And I find that to be true, and I'm sure that you do as well. The more we study these things, and a lot of these things we've already heard, all these things we've already learned, it never fails that we will learn more if we put our energy into understanding and listening to these things. On the other hand, if we ignore what we have learned, we forget what we've learned. Now in verse 15 and 16, he says, you will eat and you will be satisfied, but beware. Translation, prosperity breeds apathy. Don't let that happen. Because it is difficult for those who have plenty to remain spiritually diligent. That's just a plain and simple fact. In fact, Yeshua put it this way. It's easier for a camel to travel through a needle's eye than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. He didn't say it's impossible, but he's implying that the temptations of wealth are just very, very hard to overcome. It can be done. Abraham did it. But it's very difficult. He says in verse 17, that if, and I'm paraphrasing it, if we don't yield fruit, if we as Israel, as his people, if we don't do what we're supposed to do, then he says there's not going to be any rain and the ground is not going to yield her fruit. Again, we were taken from the dust of the earth, and as such, we are to produce the fruit. We are to produce good fruit, that is, keep God's commands. And when we do that, he says, and specifically within the context of the land of Israel, the dust from which you came is going to reflect the fruit that you yield. If you produce good fruit, the land will produce good fruit. If you don't, the land will not. In verse 21, it says that the land that the Lord has sworn to your fathers to give them is understood to hint at the resurrection. In other words, this land, I'm not just giving it to you, but I'm giving it to your fathers. They are going to enjoy the land. Of course, when Moses said this, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob were all dead. And 3,500 years later, all those people are dead. And yet, God swore to give this land to the fathers and to their seed as well. In other words, they're going to enjoy the land. When is that going to be? Obviously, in the resurrection. So there's a lot of this that Moses spoke that has not yet come to fruition. In Ekev, we see the potential of the seed, if you will, but we haven't seen the fruition of it, the head of it. And by the way, who's the head or the rosh of the body? That is the Messiah. And so there seems that there's a lot of these things that Moses said were not going to come to fruition until the Messiah comes and restores all things. In fact, in verse 24, he says, every place where you set your foot, and then he mentions the wilderness, and he mentions the Euphrates and the Hinder Sea. He is establishing the borders, but when he mentions these borders, here's some interesting things to consider. That the borders that are given to Israel to possess in Numbers chapter 34, verses 1 and 2, do not include the Euphrates. because that is understood to occur in the days of the Messiah. Another interesting thing to consider. He mentions everywhere you put your foot from the wilderness. Well, the wilderness would be Midian. And Midian is in Arabia. And there are those who believe that when they wandered through this dreadful and desolate wilderness, that it was the deserts of Arabia, or what we now call Saudi Arabia. But Israel certainly doesn't possess that, do they? But perhaps this too comes into the border when Messiah is here. And so this opens up a great deal to consider, and we don't have time to go into it, but if you're familiar with Jim and Peggy Caldwell, they have done quite a bit of research on this, and if you're interested in that particular view, then you can check out Jim and Penny Caldwell and their research. But let's end this commentary on this particular portion by saying this. There's a lot of things that God promises in this Torah portion: blessing, multiplication, life, possession of the land, etc., etc. But a great deal of what he says to us today, because these things are applicable to us today, a great deal of what he says is based on this word, if. If you do what I say to do, then I'm going to bless you, I'm going to cause you to live, I'm going to cause you to multiply, I'm going to cause all these things to happen, but you have a responsibility in this. And so, again, we don't want to look at this as just something being historically behind us and really doesn't pertain to us. The same principle applies today. What does God require of you and me? That we would do justly, that we would love mercy, and that we would walk humbly before our God. That in our tithing of anise and cumin and mint, that we would not omit the weightier matters of the Torah: justice, mercy, and faith. That we would fear Him, that we would love Him, that we would serve Him. That's what He expects of us. So that wraps it up for this Torah portion. Thank you for joining us. Until next time, Shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BuildCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BuildCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.